I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter, a leading crowdfunding site. The company enables the public to fund creative projects related to film, food, design, and music. So if you're a musician who wants to create an independent album, you can go to Kickstarter, describe your project, how much money you need, and hope that visitors to the site will contribute. Yancey co-founded the company in 2009 with Perry Chen and Charles Adler. Welcome.
Thank you.
When you were growing up, did you have a sense that you would be an entrepreneur?
Never. My entire goal growing up was to be a writer. I loved to read. I was always good at school, you know, but my dream was to be a writer. And, you know, there were various books that made me want to do that. All the President's Men was a book I reread all the time, and I very desperately wanted that kind of experience. And that's what I pursued through college. And, you know, I took it very seriously, and I got my first freelance writing jobs during college. And after school, I became a writer full time, and that was sort of living the dream, moving here to New York and doing that. And then I think there's a certain point where I realized that that world is a little small for me, that maybe I was better at more things beyond just writing and thinking about language and how to write about music or whatever the topic was. And so I sort of realized, I started working in companies and organizations, that I thrived in those situations, that I could be decisive. I knew how to do various things. But, you know, this whole thing with Kickstarter just sort of fell into it.
What do your parents do? Are they in the literary field?
Not at all. I mean, my father's sells furniture. My mother was a secretary. She recently went back to school and now is an accountant. My stepfather's a auto mechanic, and my stepmother sells real estate. So it's a working class family. I grew up certainly not having money in a very rural area in Southwest Virginia, outside of Blacksburg, Virginia, where Virginia Tech is. And it's a great place to grow up. But nothing about it would lead me to where I've gotten to be now. I think that, you know, growing up in a small town like that, you're unaware of how big the rest of the world is. And, you know, fortunately, through books and all these other ways, I got this greater sense of what possibility there was.
You grew up on a farm. Who was the farmer?
Well, we rented a house. There's this old house built in 1863, I think it was. It's a white house with a red tin roof, and you could see the house from about 5 miles away because the roof would just pop out of the trees. It was kind of nice. But it was this falling down house, and we just rented it. Our family did, for $100 a month, and farmers worked the land. So I would work for them during the summers, but they would raise cattle there, and they're, you know, cattle for beef, so they would take them away, and you'd hear the rest of the cows cry, you know, that night. And there was sort of a rhythm to it. It's a nice thing to talk about now, being in New York, because it makes me exotic, but I hated it at the time. I mean, I just wanted to read books and, you know, think about things like that. I did not thrive on country living. But I look back at it now with some level of fondness.
So the farming life wasn't for you, and you wanted to be a writer. Did your parents ever push back on that?
Not at all. I was never pressure whatsoever. I think if any, my father wanted me to be a rock star, so it might have been the opposite direction.
But. Speaking of rock star, you have an interest in music. You were a music journalist or a music critic prior to starting Kickstarter. What role did music play in your life?
It was huge. I mean, my father wanted to be a musician his entire life. He was a folk artist, and he had bands. I played very briefly in a band with him when I was in high school, a band called Rock Bottom, which is kind of appropriately named. But music was always, you know, was my identity, you know, and I was a weird kid in high school, and, you know, I was one of those kids. But music is where I saw this other world that I could possibly be a part of. And as someone who is, you know, intelligent and is curious, you know, that quest for learning more about music is a very exciting thing, especially pre-internet. Mm-hmm. You know, I would buy magazines just to look for names of bands I'd never heard of before so I could try to find out what they sounded like. So that that level of discovery was a huge part of how I grew as a person. And I played music myself, not very well, and eventually realized I couldn't make music that I myself liked, and that was a hard thing to recognize. And so then I began, you know, to write and, you know, use my ability to be pretty strong with words and to talk about records that I liked. But at a certain point, that sort of gets to be not enough. It's not, you know, emotionally fulfilling.
Since there was some type of frustration with your career prior to starting Kickstarter, to what extent did you start the company because of that, you know, you're having itchy feet to do something else versus really having a visceral interest, a holistic interest in the company?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely wholly a strong, genuine interest in what we do. I mean, it really is it. But, you know, it's not hard to look at the music industry and think this is not going to be here for very long. And, you know, I look at my very good friends who are still in that world, and not many of them are employed anymore. And so, you know, you're watching the sand leave the hourglass, and, you know, you're starting to think, I need to get out of here. So certainly that was in the air. But, you know, the Kickstarter is without question the greatest thing I've ever had the privilege to do with my life. And I don't know if I'll ever have the opportunity to do something so good again.
Your co-founder, Perry Chen, had the original idea for Kickstarter. You met him randomly at a restaurant in Brooklyn. What was that first encounter like?
Perry first had the idea in 2002. He's from New York originally, and he moved back to New Orleans, where he also went to college. And he went there, and he was trying to put on a concert. And he didn't have the money to do it. It was going to cost, you know, a lot of money up front to make it happen. And out of that, you know, he wished that there was some way he could know beforehand how many people were interested. If a certain number were interested, the show could happen because there were enough people. If there weren't, then the show wouldn't happen. And just this very simple trigger. Mm. And that was really the origin of Kickstarter right there. And so then in 2005, fall of 2005, there's a restaurant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn called Diner, and it's a nice restaurant. And I used to go there a lot, and Perry was a waiter there. And we got to be friends, and, you know, eventually one day he mentioned this idea he had. And, you know, he mentioned it to me because at the time my day job was working on the web in an editorial way, but I worked on the internet. And so that, you know, that meant I knew more about the web than he did, and so I could help him with this idea. So he shared this concept to me of this trigger that people decide for themselves what gets funded and what happens. And so, you know, I could see the merit of it, although I was a little nervous about it at first too, because I thought, well, this is American Idol. This isn't how you create great art. But as we talked it through more, just thinking of all those niches and enclaves in the world that just get ignored, but there is a support system there and a fan base there and all that who could decide for themselves. And then about a year later, we met Charles, who I mentioned before, our third founder. And Charles was more technical than either of us. He was a designer, but we still didn't have that core tech team. And that took a while to put together. So from the moment of really working on this in a very concentrated way to the site's launch, there's 4 years in between there.
What did you do to support yourself in those 4 years?
Well, I still had my day job. I was working at a music service called eMusic at the time. So I was doing that during the day, and at night I was working on this. Perry quit waiting. I mean, he was full-time trying to make Kickstarter happen. And he had some savings, and he lives light anyway. And same with Charles. You know, there's no way this doesn't happen if the two of them aren't working at this full-time and refusing to let this fail. I mean, there were numerous opportunities for us to quit. And there are times where, you know, empirically maybe we should have, but there was a persistence and a stubbornness that saw it through.
What were some turning points in those early days before the site launched that you thought, you know what, actually we're going to stick with this? And by the way, it was inexpensive for you because you were doing your other job anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I had more of a safety net, and that was a source of conflict for sure. You know, the one guy who doesn't quit his job, but I just, you know, I had no money and no way to hack it. And I just wasn't ready for that jump. And so there are a number of milestones, good and bad. I mean, the biggest mistake that we made, and a mistake that I think a lot of people probably now are making, is that we tried to outsource the development of the site. So we ourselves did not know how to code. So we went to outside firms and hired them to code the site. And, you know, we were repeatedly told by the few people we met in the tech world that this is a terrible idea, this never works. Like, this never works out. And our reaction to that was, whatever, old man, you know, what do you know? It's different for us. You don't know how it is these days. And we really believed that. And then we realized after going down that path two or three different times and it not working out in really significant ways, that we realized that this was true. So a big turning point there was we met a woman named Sunny Bates. And Sunny is a Uber connector. She's the fastest talker you will ever meet. She lives here in the city. And she's just a lovely lovely, lovely woman. Sonny shares a dog walker with a friend of Perry's from college, and so we met Sonny through that, and we became just the, you know, the two downtown boys that she got to help out, and she really liked us immediately, and we just were blown away by her, and she's just a force. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know anybody, and so we told her our idea, and we were these, you know, two earnest guys with a piece of paper, and she was like, I'll take you around. I'll introduce you. So we were able to talk to people that we definitely would not have otherwise.
Who are some of the people whom you got to talk to and whom you engaged as a result of your connection with Sonny?
Yeah, like a really important one would be Katarina Fake, who is the founder of Flickr and founder of Hunch. Through Katarina, we were introduced to Andy Bayo, and Andy was an early advisor of ours and our CTO for a little while. Andy founded a site called upcoming.org in the early 2000s that was sold to Yahoo. He runs a blog called waxy.org, which is one of the best blogs on the web. He's basically the internet's resident nice guy. And so Andy brought us a lot of credibility when we launched and when people first covered us. I think TechCrunch wrote about us the day we launched. I think they said Andy Bayo's new startup. You know, he wasn't a founder. He was involved. But, you know, we would take it. You know, it's great to be associated with him. Mm-hmm. And he also helped us find technical talent. So, mm-hmm. you know, a hard task when you're not technical yourself is you meet someone and you have no idea of how to tell how good they are. So that was a big help. And basically just for the moment we met Sonny, there was momentum.
Right. And you also have gotten support from people like Jack Dorsey, one of the Twitter founders. Is it financial support, among other things?
Yeah. He's an angel investor. We have a few really interesting angel investors, him, Joshua Schechter, who founded Delicious, and Katarina, who I mentioned, and Fred Wilson and Union Square Ventures are our primary backers.
We talk about, you know, crowdsourcing. Did you in any way feel like, as I'm starting a company related to crowdsourcing, that's what I'm doing myself, is getting a crowd of people kind of funding my business?
Well, it's funny. When we would go around with the idea and we were just, you know, a couple people with a piece of paper, people inevitably would suggest, why don't you kickstart Kickstarter, you know, get people to put the money in and create the company that way. And SEC regulations prevent any exchange of equity on a case like that. But we did take that tact in the sense that we thought, let's get as many people as possible who we think will believe in the idea, who can be advocates for us, and let's get them to put in, you know, just a small amount of money. So that's definitely been a conscious approach that we've taken because, you know, one of the big ideas of Kickstarter is that a community could be a great sense of support and encouragement, and they can spread your word far, you know, spread word about your project far and wide, and we definitely thought very hard about that.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter. We'll hear more from Yancey coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter, a leading crowdfunding site. The company enables the public to fund creative projects related to film, food, design, and music. So if you're a musician who wants to create an independent album, you can go to Kickstarter, describe your project, how much money you need, and hope that visitors to the site will contribute. Yancey co-founded the company in 2009 with Perry Chen and Charles Adler. There's a book by James Surowiecki called The Wisdom of Crowds, where the more independent people you have in a population, the more accurate an answer or an outcome will be. To what extent was that kind of ringing in your ear when you were getting this off the ground, if at all?
We read it. I mean, that came out at the time that we were working on this, and it was certainly intriguing. And, you know, it's nice to get that pop psychology reinforcement for what it is you're thinking about.
But that's all that it was?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we were driven by a few different things. I mean, a sort of a core motivation was this acknowledgement of the fact that for an idea to have any value in culture, it had to generate money. That ideas that did not, in the end, generate revenue for someone else were considered valueless. You could not get a loan for those ideas. You could not get a venture capitalist to invest. You could not get a film studio to be, you know, to finance that. A record label would be scared of it. Everyone's just looking for a return on investment because they're businesses. But yet, you know, 99% of ideas are just ideas. It's a thing in your head that you want to have exist in the real world. If it makes you money, great. No one's going to, you know, cry about that. But in the end, you just want the thing to happen. You want that personal satisfaction. So we thought, you know, we could construct a place that functions differently, where ideas are judged based on the passion of the person behind it, the quality of their craft, the connection with their audience, and what the audience itself thinks. You know, the means of doing that was almost secondary to that idea. So, you know, we get called a crowdfunding site accurately. You know, that's sort of the term the web has come up with to describe these kinds of things. But that's not a word that's anywhere on our website. It's not a word that's ever spoken about in our office. It's not a word that we ever talked about leading up to this. I mean, I could care less about crowdfunding. It's a mechanism. You know, really, it's this bigger idea that matters. This crowdfunding thing is just a means to get there.
Right. You are enabling creators to create regardless of what a market might say.
Absolutely.
How does Kickstarter work?
So Kickstarter funding is all or nothing. So I create a project. I say how much money I need to complete it, and I give myself an amount of time to reach it. We suggest 30 days. That's the typical thing that people do. So we need $5,000 in 30 days. Now, if that person is able to raise that $5,000 or more by the time of that deadline, at that point, everyone is charged, and that person gets their money, and they go and they do their thing. If they come up short of their goal, then no one is charged at all, and everyone just walks away like nothing happened. Now, people choose to back projects because they get something in exchange. So it's not a tip jar. It's not a donation platform. So if I give you $10, I get $10 of something back, a copy of the CD, a copy of the book. For higher amounts, you offer, you know, more experimental things or experiential things. So I'll name a character after you, or I'll come do a reading at your house, or we'll play a private show, or you get a walk-on role in the film. People are able to offer whatever it is that they want to do. And so 44% of projects thus far have reached their goal successfully.
Can you talk to me about some of those people who have pitched their project online? What are some of your favorite ones?
There's a project that we had early on by a woman named Emily Richmond, and she's an artist from L.A., and as part of this project, she is sailing around the world alone. It will take her 2 years to circumnavigate the globe alone, and which is a crazy thing to do. And so one of her rewards, the things that she offered, was for $15, at some point on her trip, she would take a Polaroid picture. And next time she got into port, she would mail it to you from wherever she was. And about 4 months ago, 3 months ago, I got an envelope in the mail with strange stamps on it. And I opened it up, and there was a map. And written on one side of the map was my name. And I unfolded it, and tucked inside was a Polaroid picture. And the background was the ocean, you know, faded Polaroid. In the foreground, a jungle and a beach. And on the map, she had circled the island where she was sitting in the South Pacific. On the other side, she'd written a letter describing what she saw as she took the photo. Mm-hmm. And I got this for $15. And this is something that is romantic and that has enormous, you know, emotional meaning to me. And I'm just a stranger on the internet, you know. And so that sort of thing can happen.
You contributed $15. How much was she looking to raise altogether?
She's trying to raise $7,000, and she raised about $7,500, something like that. Another one I really like, I like these sort of quixotic projects. They're where my heart kind of lies. There's another one called The Mysterious Letters, and it's by a guy and a girl who are both British. The names are Michael and Linka, and they had the very simple idea that they wanted to write everyone in the world a handwritten letter. And they were going to start with some small, specific towns. Mm. So they did a project on Kickstarter to do one in a neighborhood of Pittsburgh called Polish Hill. And so on one day, 623 residents of Polish Hill received letters from Michael and Lenka. Again, all, you know, very idiosyncratic. And predictably, people freaked out and got very scared. And it got reported to the FBI and became a big story there. Mm-hmm. And people started hanging up signs around Polish Hill that said, "Don't worry, it was an art project." There was an amazing story in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette of the reporter interviewing the shop owner, this older woman. And she was said that she thought it was a nuisance that this letter got, and that she thought it was scary and it could be terrorism, these whole ideas. And in the story it said, after the reporter writing, "After I explained to her that it was an art project, the woman removed the letter from the wastebasket and carefully smoothed it out." And I just thought that was wonderful.
When the public contributes money to support a project, it's not investing. And that's because it's illegal in the United States, although internationally regulation is different. Was that a roadblock initially, or was it your intent initially just to have people contribute?
The intent from the beginning was to not have any equity or any points or anything change hands. And that was the intent even before we knew it would be against the law, even if we thought the other way. I mean, the thinking there was that if we're asking people to look at these things and try to guess whether or not it will be a hit, you're just recreating the same mouse cage that we already have, where people are just trying to get, you know, looking to make a buck off of something. And if someone's being motivated by royalty check in 3 years for $13, what is that? Is that a better world? And so we always like this idea of it being about experiences and products that you get in exchange. Mm-hmm. So yes, there's never any sort of equity or you know, financial return that swaps hands on Kickstarter. It's strictly forbidden.
What other forms of crowd support has there been in history? Is there a precedent for this?
There is. I mean, what's funny is that this is not novel at all, in a way. You know, the original forms that art was primarily produced was through patronage, and it was patronage by the church, by royalty, by the Medici, by rich people, basically, in general. And Beethoven would perform a lot of his symphonies this way, where he would say, I will only perform this when the hall has sold out, and that's the only way this work will be debuted. You get your name in the program. I mean, it's the exact same thing as now. Whitman used to publish some of his books in that same way. In the front of the books, he'd list all the people who helped pay for this first run of printing. And so there are hundreds of examples of art being made in this way. And then right around the middle of the 20th century, we started to switch this idea of corporations subsidizing, commoditizing art, and that being the primary way that art was funded.
While this crowd support has been in existence for centuries, to what extent do you think the appetite is ripe for it now? I mean, you've been enabled by Twitter and Facebook existing, but how much have they facilitated what you're trying to do?
The lifeblood of our site is social media. At this point, Kickstarter is mentioned on Twitter about every 8 seconds, I believe it is. So people are just talking about it all the time, talking about their projects, and it's how things are getting discovered. When we were working on this in 2005, there wasn't a Twitter. I guess Facebook probably existed, but I'm not a Harvard grad, so I was not allowed to be a part of it. I mean, it was a MySpace world at that point, and you know, I'm not really sure. I think we had a MySpace widget idea for how people would spread the word, but it was unclear. And so this whole world has grown around this that's allowed this to exist in a much easier way.
Accidentally.
Yeah, accidentally.
What do you think the appetite is for something like this in other countries?
We have no way of knowing. I think that until you see it and interact with it, a lot of what we do sounds very utopian and maybe a little naive. And I think we are a little naive, but we're all right with that. And, you know, we think about this the way that Twitter or Facebook have grown, where, you know, when your first friend started a Twitter account, you probably made fun of them. You know, you thought that's ridiculous. Like, why would you ever do such a thing? And then over time, you realize the purpose that it serves, and it becomes a part of your life as well. And this is this gradual socialization of these new kinds of services, these new means of expression. And we're on that same kind of timeline, and we have that same level of patience for this. I feel sure that with time that this can be a thing that everyone will feel comfortable with.
So artists have this reputation of feeling uncomfortable talking about the business side of their work, yet your site is all about artists connecting with potential supporters or sources of money. Can you talk to me a little bit about that dichotomy?
I mean, you're saying out loud how much money you need to do something. And the way the site is structured, it's not just about money. It's more about the thing that you're doing. But yet, we're all very uncomfortable talking about money in public. We'd rather talk about anything else than money. And for artists in particular, you know, you're just running for money. You don't want to think about it. That's part of the point. And so there is that level of discomfort, and there's that hurdle that we have to get over. And I'm incredibly sympathetic to it. I mean, I feel very similarly. And I also think that people aren't sure about putting themselves out there in the world. You know, J.D. Salinger would be a terrible Kickstarter creator. You know, it's not for everybody. But I think that with time, people can see that this is about more than just the cash. It's about opportunity. It's about building an audience, all those other things.
Along those lines, you know, I asked you prior to the interview, well, how much money have you raised? And you don't want people to know that, which is compatible with this whole artist mentality of wanting to keep that separate. But that doesn't necessarily work anymore. I mean, you see artists, they have to be great marketers, and it's in their best interest.
It's true. You know, for us, in talking about our own financial backing and our own, you know, things like that, we don't view it as being terrifically interesting. So we just didn't feel like that added anything to our story, that it didn't feel like us. It was someone else's story of us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter, a company that enables the public to fund creative projects. Do you know anybody else with the name Yancey, incidentally?
I've heard tell. There was an NFL player named Yancey. There's an actress named Yancey, but I've never met anyone face-to-face. It's a Southern last name, traditionally. I was named after a family friend. I hated my name for a lot of my life, and only when, I guess it was in high school, I decided to embrace it. But yeah, it's an unusual one.
So going back to the early days of the company, what was more challenging for you than you thought? I mean, you've had kind of a charmed existence, having the support of the media and this strong network of people helping you out.
Well, those people were not there always. You know, when we launched, it was just us. We were a team of five. We had no one of any weight behind us. We had no big investment, and when we would go around to venture capital firms and talk to people about our idea, people did not like it. People did not respond to it. I think that we had that four-year gap where the site couldn't launch, and that was not a happy period. And we would have launched that site in 2006 if we could have, but we couldn't. And you know, you wake up in the morning and you think, is today the day that the three people in Palo Alto with this exact same idea, they launched theirs because they worked a little bit harder, you know, and you have these kinds of anxieties, and no one was getting paid, and it was, you know, it was bootstrapping all the way. You know, I think that there was a lot of emotional toll of especially me having a full-time job and my partners being both fully committed. And that caused a lot of stress and a lot of tension, as you can probably understand. Now the problems are interesting. Now the problems are growth.
You founded the company with Perry Chen and Charles Adler, and they were working on the company full time, and you weren't. So why did they keep you on board as a co-founder if you weren't carrying your weight?
That's a good question. I don't know. We're friends, so that helps. It was not a great period. I don't know the answer to that.
You have a part of your site devoted to product design, and that has been somewhat controversial. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So we started Kickstarter as a platform for creative projects. We meant that pretty broadly. So that's film, music, tech, comics, you know, dance, all kinds of things like that. And then in September 2010, we had a project from two guys in New York named Dan and Tom, and it was a project called The Glyph. And it's a tripod mount for an iPhone 4, and it's a little simple piece of rubber. And they put together a video where they explained how they designed this thing, and they had a very clever sort of commercial for it. And it was a very, very well-done project. And they put it in the design category, and it was a design project, and they were trying to raise $10,000, and they raised about $140,000 very quickly. And the project was basically functioning as a pre-order mechanism. People were buying the Glyph from them. And that was the first time we'd had a project like that. And it opened the floodgates to a lot of product design kind of things. And quite a few of those were terrible, and we turned most of those down. But at one point, we had another big one come through. It was by a man named Scott Wilson, who's a designer who lives in Chicago, who designed the Xbox Kinect, among a lot of other big things. And he had a project called the TikTok. And what he did is he designed a watch band that would turn an iPod Nano into a wristwatch. And he was looking to raise $15,000 to do it. And after a month, the project ended with him raising $945,000. And so for his project, that was functioning as, again, as a pre-order mechanism, and some 14,000 people bought this thing. But more than that, they also got a story that they were part of. They were part of the creation of this phenomenon. I mean, it was international news, this project. And all those people got bragging rights and got to be a part of it. But it's also more commercial than the kinds of things that we have traditionally supported on Kickstarter. I mean, our biggest category is documentary film. Documentaries have raised, you know, $15 million on Kickstarter. And something like this, you know, the creation of like a gadget seems a little bit divorced from that. You know, because of the success of the TikTok and other projects like it, we've had a real influx of proposals of people looking to do these kinds of things. And we lit in almost everything at this point after a lot of internal debate. We sort of opened wider to this, but we're still not entirely sure how we feel about it. You know, we like this idea of Kickstarter being a place where you put an idea into the world and the crowd decides, right, whether or not it should happen or it shouldn't. But yet we're not a fully open platform. We don't allow everything. So this has really pushed some of our philosophy a little bit. And to be honest, we're not entirely sure where we stand.
To some extent, these people, even if they have the commercial incentive, are still creators and they're still being creative. So
yeah, just because they happen to work in a different medium than one I feel more comfortable in, you know, that's just as much about my bias as it is anything. And we're very aware of that. Mm-hmm. And we're also aware that, you know, when we started Kickstarter, it was ours. It was this idea we had to protect. But with each day, it's a little bit less ours and it's more just a thing that exists on its own in the world that a lot of people contribute to. So, you know, you even have to question how much a voice do we have the right to have about mm-hmm. this thing.
What do you do outside of work that gives you pleasure right now?
Right now it's primarily riding my bike. But, you know, outside of that, I read. I read, you know, 3 or 4 books a week probably.
What 2 books have you read this week?
Well, let's see. Right now I'm reading the Tom Shales Oral History of ESPN, which I find fascinating and I actually find to be a really good startup book because it's about the origins of this, what is now a huge, huge company just based on being founded by 2 men and basically how they lost control of the company and how it's become this other big thing. And then I'm reading The Bridge, the David Remnick biography of Obama. I recently read The Medium is the Massage by Malcolm McLaren, which is a classic 60s sort of post-Marxist theory book about sort of the philosophy of media. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. I read that 3 times in a day. It's a little 100-page book. Mm-hmm. And another one that was I really loved, I've read multiple times, is You Are Not a Gadget by Jaron Lanier, which is a really good book about sort of some philosophies of technology. And he takes a very sort of pessimistic view in a lot of ways about, you know, what technology has done for us. And I enjoy reading those kinds of opinions.
He advises Microsoft.
I believe he does. He also invented virtual reality and he does. He's a very smart man with some crazy ideas.
Yes. And he has great dreadlocks.
He does.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter. Coming up, we'll meet Roy and Bertrand Sosa, co-founders of Netspend. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Roy and Bertrand Sosa, co-founders of Netspend, the first prepaid debit card company for the underbanked population in the United States. Netspend was launched in 1999 and targets people who don't have access to credit cards or hold bank accounts. Roy and Bertrand started the company out of their one-bedroom apartment in Texas with $750. They later raised $1.5 billion in an IPO in 2010 and sold the company in early 2013 to Total System Services, a payment processing company, for approximately $1.4 billion. They are the co-founders of Empower Ventures, an investment fund focused on financial service companies for the underbanked. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
You immigrated from Mexico to the United States in 1986 when you were teenagers. What were your first impressions of America, Bertrand?
As the World Turns, because I learned English watching As the World Turns with my mother. And the other parts came from watching Transformers in the morning.
How about you, Roy?
Missing the bus, going to my first day of school in Austin, Texas, and having my tennis shoes stolen and not speaking the language. Yeah, it was not a good start. Pretty tough when coming back from a country where, for me, everything clicked.
Now, you moved from Mexico with your mother, and she wanted to kind of reinvent herself. She had been working in business administration, and she wanted to study medicine. Where was your father in this?
Our father, he's a professor of economics, and so they had split a few years back, and so he was in Mexico City.
Roy, you joined the Marine Corps after high school before entering college. Given your allegiance to Mexico, why did you join the Marines?
Literally, Saddam had invaded Kuwait, and I had been in this country for 4 years, and I had really come to the conclusion that whereas before I wanted to get back to Mexico as soon as possible, I had come to just love this country and the opportunities. And I felt that there was no way that I was ever really going to feel that this was my home, the same way that my peers that have been born here. And so I just had this idea of what better way than join the Marines during time of war.
After college, you both worked at MCI, the telephone company.
Now Verizon.
It was at MCI that the idea for Netspend hatched. And it seems like you are both very unlikely people to start a financial services company, especially given that you were at a telephone company and you didn't have a background in financial services. How did the idea for Netspend come to be?
We were living together at the time when we overlapped work at MCI WorldCom, and we were just talking about the internet boom and how there's a new business being hatched every day, it seemed like. And so you can imagine, especially in Austin, Texas, Michael Dell has just entered into the picture. And without living in Austin, I don't know if we would have had the momentum of entrepreneurship that we felt. Literally, it happened over a few days where we started talking about doing something together. I remember him walking into my room and saying, I got it. Mm-hmm. We're going to enable payments over the internet.
At the time, e-commerce was just blooming. And people were starting to buy things online. However, there was this whole population of people who didn't have access to credit cards. And the thought was, how are they going to transact? In what way did this stem from your own experience or frustration with the payment system?
As a student at the University of Texas and having had financial aid checks coming in from my GI Bill, I had come to understand that if I came in and I deposited my $2,000 check at my bank account, deposited my check on Friday at 4 p.m., guess what? Even though I had a debit card, I could not get the funds to clear my account until after midnight Monday, which puts it Tuesday. So if I needed to buy books on the internet, or if I wanted to buy flowers for my girlfriend from 1-800-Flowers, I couldn't do anything. The electronics seem to be there. They have my money. Why? Why can't I do this? And that was really what motivated us, is that we cannot possibly be the only ones.
While it was the early days, prepaid cards did exist in the form of phone cards, for example. And in what way did phone cards inspire you to just apply it to a different area?
In a big way for me. I mean, we were working directly in the industry, and we had context coming from Mexico where very popular way of transacting.
When we were at MCI, one of our college jobs initially was to sign people up to switch in long distance. And curiously enough, switching people from AT&T to MCI, that was easy. The ones that were super difficult were not only immigrants, but your average American that had gotten a $400, $500 phone bill and they couldn't pay it. And they had gotten so burned with that experience that they decided, you know what, I'm going to buy prepaid cards. And we could tell that customer, Mr. Customer, you know, you can have the service for 5 cents a minute, and the prepaid card is 30 cents. And the customer would tell us, yes, I know. I know it's more expensive, but you know what? When I'm done with the card, I'm done with the card.
More control.
It's control. As a person, I have problems about maybe not exercising enough, maybe not having the right diet. And certainly, I'm going to have a problem with spending and saving. And if you can give me something where I can have control, that would be very powerful.
You launched the company with $750, which is basically the amount of money that it costs to incorporate.
$750 was utilized to incorporate, and that was really the catalyst to no going back.
So we put a list of friends and family, and it's really funny, the 20 people that we put on the list, they ended up not giving us any money. But what we ended up getting, these first investors are former employees at MCI. So think about people that were call center agents. When you're talking about an investment from a friend or a former employee that is $5,000 when their annual income, I know for a fact because they used to work for me, was $60,000, it's a big deal.
And then you looked to venture capital and you got a lot of no's because you didn't have experience. What were some other reasons why venture folks did not support you initially?
I'll give you the response that we got from one particular investor that we were looking for money from. And he looked at us and he said, "You guys are hilarious. It's like you're trying to go to the Super Bowl and win, but you've got two players." I mean, I didn't even know what venture capital was mm-hmm. when we were looking for venture capital.
You ended up raising money from the help of the Small Business Administration. They had this SBIC program, which insured investments from venture funds, right? It backed or collateralized investments from venture funds. Is that right?
That is correct.
They mm-hmm. supported one of our investors, early investors. They had received some money from the government, and it turned out that we were one of the portfolio companies of the year for the government.
And who was the venture firm?
Jeff and Orr
here out of New York.
In the early days, you persuaded MasterCard to partner with you. How did you meet them?
We were introduced to them by our partner bank out of Texas.
And to their credit, they were very open. You got to remember, 1998, the internet is expanding. And back in those days, we basically said, look, we have an agreement with ExxonMobil for distribution of these cards. They need to be able to get their cash into the system. And how are you going to deal with that? And if you don't want to help us, that's fine. But then this is our first stop, and maybe we can go to American Express, or maybe we can go to Visa, but somebody's going to do it.
So Exxon was a real important ally for you in convincing the likes of MasterCard to work with you.
ExxonMobil being Fortune One.
So, for example, when you think about MasterCard or Visa, they do not issue cards. Banks do. The biggest retail bank in America back then had a total of 5,000 branches. ExxonMobil had 15,000 locations. So the concept that you can actually reach people through a retail location instead of a bank branch was really an innovation in itself. The other thing that we also had was our technology. So because the stuff that we wanted to do had never been done before, the incumbents, they were very rigid. If you as a bank said, I want to change this and that, they would say, okay, we can make those changes, but it's going to cost you millions of dollars and it's going to be 2-3 years. They also were operating on mainframes. We had the benefit of, we were working on servers from the internet age where instead of spending $20 million on infrastructure, we could do it for a couple million dollars faster, better.
How did you convince Exxon to make your cards available to the population?
They took a leap of faith on a pilot in Texas. And so literally hopped on a plane, went to see them in Fairfax, Virginia, said, hey, we want to do this. Here's a card. I remember putting a card in front of the gentleman that handled U.S. distribution for their C-stores. He picked it up, looked at it. This, by the way, had been a card that I had designed personally and printed and laminated and all that. And I remember he looked at it and said, okay, let's do it. And he signed the term sheet.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Bertrand and Roy Sosa, co-founders of NetSpend, a pioneer of prepaid debit cards for the underbanked. Launched in 1999, NetSpend provides cards and other financial services to people who don't have access to credit or bank accounts. It occurred to me that you are innovating at the bottom of the pyramid. You're serving people who have real needs, and one day these services will be or eventually reused by mainstream customers. And usually when we think of innovation, sometimes it happens top down, like at the top of the pyramid, and then eventually, you know, the people at the bottom would benefit. Have you thought about that dynamic?
We have. Today, globally, we've now have programs in places like Kosovo, where we completely help rebuild the entire financial system in terms of the infrastructure for card issuance and acceptance. And, you know, the small business owner that now can order enzymes for his dairy business that he couldn't before.
Enzymes, yeah.
And that he couldn't do it before. And you asked this question of, you know, you start innovating at the bottom of the pyramid. Well, we have to be super low cost. You obviously can't talk about big fees. We have programs where literally we make $1 per customer per year. Okay, so for you to make it work, you have to leverage technology. You have to leverage partnerships. But once you do that, then all of a sudden you say, wow, I can actually deliver services to the top of the pyramid more efficiently, better service than the incumbents that have been used to high fees because I had to figure it out. So instead of building a branch, I partnered with a grocery store. Instead of building a branch, I partnered with an airline.
Or a telco.
Or a telco.
You are no longer affiliated with NetSpend. You started an investment fund called Empower, which invests in financial service companies serving the underbanked population. And unfortunately, it got off to a rough start in that you were the subject of a lawsuit and injunctions were filed against you from NetSpend, from the very company that you founded. And that was a tumultuous period for you, I'm sure. And the company contended that you were taking employees and that you had a non-compete and that you were starting companies that competed directly with NetSpend. What was your response to that?
No, my two cents on that is that it was a silly time for both of us. There's just no reason for it. We clear the air between both sides.
The short answer is I can tell you all those things were dismissed. But at the same time, I will also tell you because of confidentiality and the dismissal and whatnot, we really don't talk about it. But I can tell you from a human perspective, it is the equivalent of being sued by your child. For me, it was even more awkward as a founder to think about the fact that, okay, at the time, we were the largest individual shareholders. So if NetSpend won, we lost. But if NetSpend lost, we lost. And it just didn't make sense. You know, I've never sued anybody in my entire life. To me, it's disappointing when companies or individuals view the game as a zero sum. Like, if you're winning, I must be losing. So how do I get a piece of that? NetSpend had the opportunity to go international for many years. Never did. There's nothing that prevents them from doing that.
So what you're saying is NetSpend decided not to go into these other markets internationally, and there you saw an opportunity elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, we started doing things around mobile payments right away and going into other countries right away. And, you know, the product line spectrum that we have today is pretty significantly different than what you see back then.
Your focus now is on Rev Worldwide, which is a portfolio company of Empower, and they have a network of payment companies for those without access to banking. So similar to NetSpend, but international. What are some examples, or who are some of the people whom are being affected by this?
In rural Mexico, there's no cell phone coverage. There's no mobile coverage. So we partnered with the telegraph company and with Huawei, who actually came in and put a satellite antenna, and we enabled everybody in a township of 500 families to be able to operate and be able to have both access to telecommunications, but also to the banking system.
The people in Mexico that are using the Mi Phone product are impacted in a very, very real way. I mean, you have this merchant that's selling chicken, and now because he's able to take phone orders and have them be paid to his cell phone, he doesn't have to collect the cash and then take the cash to the bank. And, you know, all these inefficiencies that when you think about, I mean, we may take them for granted, but when for somebody to go half a day across town, another half a day, come back, it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. It's a big deal in terms of time and money. And we have successfully bridged that divide through the mobile phone and through a debit card. Another way that Rev is impacting around the world, you're talking about cab drivers in Australia that are getting paid via their driver's card. Through our technology, their headquarters disperses the money directly to them. And, you know, I can go on and on about all the different examples.
Your mom is living in Texas currently. What does she make of all this?
It's really funny you ask that question because throughout the early years at NetSpend, I don't think she really understood what we were doing. When it relates to things about work, it's more about I need to, you know, help her reset her pen, or I get a tickle out of that every single time.
Where was your father in this?
My father, who's a professor, he still would like for me to go out and finish some sort of graduate school. He's never been a big pro-capitalist or entrepreneur supporter, so there's a bit of unfinished business there.
You said your father's a professor of economics in Mexico?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hmm. Is he socialist?
How did you guess? Why would have led you to believe that?
All you have to do is meet my mother and my father to understand why Roy is half mission-driven and half capitalistic-driven.
I grew up going to summer camps with the Boy Scouts, and every other year going to summer camps with the Cuban Pioneers. And I grew up with a poster of $6 Million Man next to the poster of Ernesto Che Guevara. They go hand in hand. I don't think you divorce one from the other.
You guys are two immigrants from Mexico, and Netspend had a $1.5 billion IPO in 2010, and more recently was sold for almost $1.5 billion. Were you like, is this really happening to me?
Yeah, all the time. You know, what I really pinch myself is it's not necessarily the IPO or Netspend or the prepaid. I pinch myself that I was able to find a path of entrepreneurship. When I discovered that entrepreneurs, it wasn't necessarily a dirty word, but it was a very empowering feeling, it blew my mind.
I want to elaborate on that concept of dirty word. From an entrepreneur's perspective, in Mexico, an entrepreneur is somebody who doesn't know what they want to do. Being an entrepreneur is the guy that is just sort of wheeling and dealing. And so it was fantastic to really have come to a country at a time where this is really exploding. And if you can believe that, a couple of Mexican immigrants that came in on a tourist visa, that the visa had an expiration date, and that by all means should not be here, that we could create a company that could lead an industry that could create so many jobs.
That is extremely empowering.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
My guests have been the financial service entrepreneurs Roy and Bertrand Sosa. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.